I'm Kel Winslow. I'm hosting a new KZYX series that begins this morning, talking about California. I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center. I live on the coast near Casper. In this series, I'm going to talk to Californians about California. These discussions will, I hope, continue and expand on last year's series here, Community and Ecology. Our guests will include writers, activists, academics, and others. We'll lead off today with Gray Brecken. Gray Brecken is an historical geographer at UC Berkeley whose chief interests are the state of California, the environmental impact of cities upon their hinterlands, and the invisible landscape of New Deal public works. He's author of Imperial San Francisco and founder of the Living New Deal Project. He has as well a wide-ranging experience as a California environmentalist. His book, Farewell Promised Land, chronicles the Golden State's declining environmental and social health. Gray was the keynote speaker at our Community and Ecology Conference a year ago in Casper. Other speakers will include Mike Davis, Rebecca Solnit, Ruthie Gilmore, Fernando Capizan, Julie Guthman, Frank Bardicky, and Bob Brenner. I hope you'll join us in the next weeks on Thursday mornings. So good morning, listeners. Good morning, Gray, and welcome to KZYX.
Good morning, Cal.
Well, Gray, I thought I'd start off, since this is the very beginning of the series, with a fairly general question, and you can help us here. Let me just ask you, what do you think about when you think about California? What kinds of things do you like to talk about when you talk about California?
Oh, big topic, big state. I think that of California, a place I grew up in, is one of the most favored places on planet Earth. It's an amazing place. Of course, it's very varied in its scenery, its topography. And then it has this extraordinarily wonderful climate, at least as long as you're living along the coast, which is so equable, so that we're in winter right now, and of course much of the country is suffering, as most places do in the winter, and we have this very mild climate where we don't have snow outside of the Sierra particularly in the Bay Area here. So I love California. I grew up here. Love driving around it, although I'm trying to reduce my carbon footprint. And it's just it's a fascinating place. A lot of very interesting, very creative people are drawn to California. And so I find it just never ending in its fascination. Although at the same time, I'm very concerned about what's happening to it environmentally.
So how did you choose what you've called historical geography as a pathway to studying and talking about California?
Well, I could have gone into history. I came back to UC Berkeley late in life to get my PhD. That was in the 1990s, and I could have gone into history. But I like historical geography, or I should say just geography, because it's such a broad field, and at the UC Berkeley department, we have so many students and professors working in so many different fields. I just like the breadth of it because I'm a sort of born generalist myself. And so I like that. And also, historians think that they have only recently invented environmental history, but in fact, that goes back a long ways in geography. It's what geographers have always studied, is how humans and the environment interrelate, and particularly the kind of abuses that humans do upon the planet and the various places they live in. So I just find it a fascinating field to be in, so, and I really enjoy my colleagues.
So just go back a minute, and how far back do you go when you say that that's what geographers have always done? Can you give us an example of what you mean by that?
Well, yes. You can go back to Alexander von Humboldt, the great German he was a nobleman, but he largely founded the modern field of geography. He loved to travel and was traveling all over Europe and South America and left his name all over the place, even in the United States, where he never actually visited. So you could take it back to the early 19th century. I like to date it from the publication of George... George Perkins Marsh, his great book, Man and Nature, which came out in 1864. And in Man and Nature, he looks at how humans have dealt with the earth, going back to actually classical times. And he was, in 1864, even then, quite alarmed at what was happening environmentally, especially in the United States. And he said that we are tearing the paneling off of our drawing room and burning it in the fireplace to seethe our pots of porridge. And by that, he realized that humans were really drawing down the resource base that they had inherited, and it didn't look good. He's a bit of a pessimist, as am I. But this book was published only a few years after Darwin, but it's far less known than Darwin's great book on evolution. But people really should know Man and Nature because it really is a pioneering study in how humans abuse the earth.
And yet so much of California talk is celebration, isn't it? The last time I talked to you, I think you told me that you were working on a piece about the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco. And of course, the origins of that project were in a huge California celebration. What was it, the Panama Pacific Expedition?
International Exposition.
Exposition, right.
It's a long and clunky title, so we just call it the PPIE.
The PPIE. What are you working on?
I'm working on you can't call it a building, what we would today call a site work by Bernard Maybeck from the 1915 World's Fair it's the Palace of Fine Arts. It's the only building that survived in situ from the fair. It's still there in the marina. It's about to have its 100th anniversary. It'll be in 2015. I saw that when I was a teenager wandering around San Francisco, and probably around 1962 or 63, and it just knocked my socks off because, as it does everybody who sees it, because it's so unlike any other classical revival building you've ever seen. Most of it is just decoration on a utilitarian semicircular shed, which is where the exploratorium is now. But the rest of it, the columns and the great rotunda and the landscape around it, is largely decorative. And yet, it's incredibly powerful. It just really moves people when they see it, although most people don't put that in words of why they're moved by it. So I'm starting to work on a book about the meaning of the Palace of Fine Art, the kind of deep meaning of it, and what I think Maybeck was trying to accomplish in building that building. You see, the fair itself was a celebration of triumph. It was a make-believe imperial city built next to the Golden Gate, as if it had been there for centuries, because it was made out of an artificial travertine, which is the material that Rome is made out of. And so it was a kind of celebration of San Francisco as a modern-day Rome by the Pacific. But then Maybeck bookends it at one end with this building, which is a ruin. It was a gigantic artificial ruin, like something out of Piranesi. And what it was, I think, was a warning about hubris. It's what happens to empires when they overreach themselves. And so it's a very, very powerful site work. And I've been fascinated with it now for probably about 50 years.
What specifically was the purpose of the exposition? Could you just tell listeners a little about that?
Sure. The exposition was really a celebration of the completion of the Panama Canal, and then, of course, of the business that San Francisco's leaders thought it would bring in to San Francisco through the Golden Gate. Now, San Diego's business leaders were equally enthusiastic because they were, of course, closer to the Panama Canal, and they have a nice bay there, and they thought that the freighters would stop in San Diego before they came on to San Francisco. So they staged a little World's Fair of their own, which you can still see in Balboa Park. They didn't rip that one down. So officially it's a celebration of the Panama Canal, but it's also to tell the world that San Francisco is back again and back in business 9 years after it had been destroyed by the earthquake and fire of 1906. So it's an invitation to the world. It was to stimulate the local economy. Unfortunately, it opened while we were just getting into the First World War. Well, we weren't in it yet, but Europe was in it by that time. So there's an irony in it, in that it was supposed to celebrate international goodwill and progress. And meanwhile, white civilization in Europe is ripping itself to pieces in this kind of suicidal frenzy. So there was a kind of sadness overlaying the fair, too. But it was magnificent because it was built as a walled classical city, which was much of it was Rome, some of it was Constantinople, but a lot of it was Venice, too, because it was a waterfront fair. And so they took elements from the Piazza San Marco in Venice, and it was a magnificent fair. It was multicolored. As I said, it was made out of travertine. It had 8 exhibition palaces with themes. There were gardens. It was brilliantly planned. So it's always been fascinating from that point of view. But the most fascinating building of all was Maybeck's Palace of Fine Arts.
Just 2 more questions.
I just one other thing. The most famous statue at the fair.
I was just going to ask about that. Yeah.
You know what that statue is.
Well, I was going to ask you about that.
Oh, well, it was James Earl Fraser's The End of the Trail. Which you've seen all over the place. You know, you could buy it as a little coffee table statuette, for example, at Bruner's. People recognize that silhouette of the exhausted Indian slumping on his nearly dead pony with his flaccid spear, everything sort of slumping to the ground. And it was up on a big pedestal. It was a huge statue. And it's a fascinating one because equestrian statues from the time of Rome have always been about triumph, about conquest, about power. It's about conquest over nature in the form of the animal, but also over people. This statue is different. It's about defeat. And when you really begin to look at it, you realize it is a sentimentalization of the genocide of the Native Americans. It celebrates their defeat because it was paired with another statue which wasn't as famous and which most people aren't aware of, called the Old Pioneer. And this is an old white pioneer on a souped-up pony. He's got an erect rifle as opposed to the Indian's flaccid spear. And he's marching forward into the West, whereas the Indian is, after the fair, he was going to be placed on a bluff on Land's End facing the setting sun, which was symbolic of the tragic extinction of the American natives. And this statue became so famous even during the fair that there were many efforts to save it, to recast it in permanent materials. In fact, what happened is the town of Visalia in the San Joaquin Valley got it, shipped it down there. It was in a park for many years. And then the Cowboy Museum in, I think it's Oklahoma City, managed to borrow it, make a cast out of it, send that to Visalia, and they kept the original, which they built an almost cathedral around at the Cowboy Museum, the National Cowboy Museum. So it has a very strange history, and it's very uncomfortable when you actually begin thinking about what that statue represents.
And I think there's one other uncomfortable issue that you raised about the palace and its history, and that's the environmental one. Was it the story of Secretary Lane coming to speak and the connection to Hetch Hetchy?
Yes, Secretary Lane was the former city attorney for San Francisco and a close friend of Mayor James Phelan, who was the promoter of the Hetch Hetchy water system. And that was so controversial at the beginning of the 20th century that it kept being defeated and then passed and then defeated and passed. It was a real seesaw until Woodrow Wilson came in as president and appointed Franklin Lane as his Secretary of the Interior. And at that point, the fix was in. The Raker Act passed in 1913, and San Francisco got an exemption to build a dam and a reservoir in probably America's most famous national park and to use half of Yosemite National Park as its watershed and water supply.
And one last thing, I was thinking about people, you know, people up on the coast here. When we come to the city, we pass the palace, you know, every time we do it, and it's always
yes.
a thought-provoking introduction to a visit. And what about the, just out of curiosity, my own curiosity, the Weeping Women? What's that all about?
Oh, well, everybody wonders about it, and they were supposed to. It's a very unclassical thing to do, to have women facing away from you, great huge statues of women. When you see them, they're up on these big boxes, which were sometimes described as caskets, on the top of the colonnade, and they're about 22 feet high. They're gigantic. And they're looking, there are four at each corner. I should say there's one at each corner of these boxes, and they're looking into the boxes, so not only are they facing away from you, so you can't see their faces, but their butts are sticking out at you, although they're discreetly draped. This is very unconventional. So one of the things that they're doing is they're increasing the feeling of sadness and of mystery to the building because they're unavailable to you. But the other thing is that those big boxes were meant to be planters, and they were supposed to be overgrown with oak trees and vines, according to Maybeck's drawing. The whole building was supposed to be smothered in plants. And what Maybeck was getting to there, he was looking at the engravings of Piranesi and the paintings of Roman and Greek ruins and fantasies also at that time. And the idea is that it expresses, as Maybeck said, the mortality of human wishes, the fading grandeur of an empire that was once great but is now ruined and is lost in a jungle. A very odd and, I think, kind of wonderful idea. It's like a huge garden folly. But what it is ultimately is a memento mori. It's a reminder of death, not only for the individual, but for overreaching empires, because everything comes to this in the end. It comes to ruin. So it's a remarkable idea. Unfortunately, the palace was falling into ruin itself in the 1960s. It was all just plaster over wood, and it was falling into ruin when I first saw it. It was a fascinating building at that time. And the city and the state and a millionaire named Walter Johnson chipped in enough money to do a bare-bones rebuild of the palace in precast concrete. But they didn't have enough money to rebuild it as it was originally, so a lot of the detail was left off of it. And unfortunately, they didn't plant it at that time the way Maybeck wanted. The original structure couldn't take the weight of the earth, and so they never planted it. But when they rebuilt it in concrete, they could have done that. But they did, probably because of cost constraints. So what you're looking at now is a partially rebuilt palace and one that doesn't have the essential landscaping. As a matter of fact, last year it went through its third restoration, and it looks pretty raw right now. They've trimmed a lot of the plants, and many of the planters don't have the planters down below don't have plants in them, and so there's a kind of kind of harsh, raw, new quality to it, which is almost exactly the opposite of what Maybeck wanted. He wanted the whole thing to be in a state of advanced ruin.
This is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. I'm introducing today a new series, Californians Talking About California. Our guest today is Gray Brecken. Gray is a historical geographer at the University of California in Berkeley and the author of a number of important works. Including Gray, your book, Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. In that, you talk a lot about San Francisco, but you also discuss what you call its cantado. Is that right, cantado?
Yes.
I
wanted to use the Italian word. It's not quite an exact translation for hinterland, but I guess that's the closest. Because Italians see the world as a duality between the città and the contado, that is, the city and the countryside around that sustains it. And traditionally, in Italian cities, they were confined themselves by a wall, usually on a hilltop, for defensive reasons. If you've been to those towns, you know the city ends abruptly, or at least it did traditionally. It ends abruptly, and you look from the walls out over the landscape where the farmers are, and they bring their produce into the city, and they trade them for money and finished goods, and then the city dwellers use the country itself for fun and sport. There's a great mural on the city hall in Siena, in Italy, that shows good government as a perfect symbiosis between the city and the countryside. But what happens is that as the city becomes larger, as the population continues to grow, the city becomes increasingly parasitic on its contado rather than symbiotic, and it draws more and more to it, and at the same time taking from the contado. So, and we almost never think about that, because for those of us who live in cities, it's very comfortable as long as the infrastructure is working, and it becomes kind of a bubble, an illusion. So the irony is that the larger that the city becomes, the more dependent it is on its contado, which is, for all great cities, their contado is now the entire planet. The city becomes more dependent on the contado, but the people become less aware of their dependence, and so they just want more. And that means more water, more minerals, more fuel, etc. For those of you up in Mendocino, it meant, of course, more trees. And I was initially going to have a chapter on forests, because I wanted to show that from the moment of the gold rush, even actually a bit before the gold rush, but from the gold rush on, San Francisco goes off like a nuclear weapon, environmentally speaking, and this shockwave moves out from San Francisco of the exploitation of the resources of first California, then adjacent states, and into the Pacific. And the most noticeable one, I suppose, is the logging off of the old growth redwood forests, which, of course, were vastly larger than they are now. The largest trees were in the Oakland Hills, we think, and those were gone by 1855 to build San Francisco. And they were gone so fast that we don't have any photographs of them and very few little information. But those were monster trees. And once those were gone, then they worked down the peninsula. They worked up into Marin, of course, then into Humboldt and Mendocino, and then the Sierra Nevada fed into it, too. So all of this lumber went to build San Francisco, but it also was exported all over the country, all over the Pacific. Redwood makes wonderful railroad ties, so it was sent down to Peru and Chile and out to Hawaii. But it was devastating for the people who lived in those areas, especially Native Americans, and it was devastating for the environment to suddenly remove or annihilate this ecosystem that had built up over millions of years, and it was just a fatal blow for it to just mow it all down. But in the process, it made some huge fortunes for a few people in San Francisco. And that's one of the things I try to do in San Francisco, is to show how all cities, I think, operate and for whom. So I give agency to the great families of San Francisco that are like the great families everywhere. The wealth flows disproportionately to a few people, and those are the ones who build the great mansions up on the hills, who acquire huge ranches, and whose descendants are still around today, appearing in the society columns.
I think by the time of, say, the end of the Second World War, there were about six families who controlled redwood timber in Northern California, and they all were settled in San Francisco, as far as I know. Does that make sense?
That sounds about right. Yeah, I didn't know the exact number, but yes, they settle in San Francisco, and then they marry with other great mining and ranching and railroad families as well, too. Some of them marry their daughters off into the European nobility, so a lot of these families have relatives now on chateaus and manor houses in Europe. It's a fascinating study, and it just goes on and on, you know. It's one of the reasons I point out for the Bohemian Club, because the Bohemian Club, among other things, is one way that old money manages to refresh itself by coming in contact with new money, in this case, largely Silicon Valley, weapons, contracting, etc. And they all mix it up. The boys mix it up at the Bohemian Club. And it's a way to maintain the lifestyle to which you have been accustomed.
I think we know more probably about timber up here than we do about some of the other subjects in your book. Maybe you could just say a word about mining before we move on. There still are sort of popular images of the grizzled prospector out in the hills looking for gold, but mining was more than that, probably. We probably all know that. Could you say how mining was part of this process you're discussing?
Yeah, the first chapter is all on mining. It sort of lays the groundwork for the thesis of the book, which is that cities are traditionally about mining, extractive industries that feed the city, and that mining and war are intimately connected throughout history, because war is often about acquiring the resources of one's neighbors, whether that's gold and silver, whether it's iron or trees, petroleum. It could be trees. Trees have been a cause for wars in the past. So mining is non-renewable, extractive activity, unlike the way that much agriculture was practiced traditionally. You just basically continue to make extractions from your bank account until it's all gone, and you don't think about putting anything back. So California is a good example of that because, of course, it's famous for its gold rush, not so famous for the silver rush, which followed that, but that was almost more important than the gold rush. Mining, as I say, is a cause of war, and there was a great deal of it in California, and it's left enormous ruin behind it, because mining also externalizes its costs whenever possible in order to increase profits. So it's just an attack on the environment, and the wastes which are left from mining and smelting are left behind for others to take care of. I call it passing the cost downriver, downwind, and downtime. And so we today are stuck with the bill for example, the mercury mines that were all over California and the places that mercury went to refine gold and silver, which now contaminate the streams of California and Nevada as well, too. Wherever there was mining for precious metals, you're going to find mercury, too, which was used for making amalgam. Now, the other thing is, too, you mentioned the image of the grizzled old prospector. The other image that you see is of the gold panner in the streams looking for placer gold, and those are the preferred images of miners. But placer mining with a pick and shovel and a pan and rocker, that only lasted actually for a few years. And then you had the shift to capital and technology intensive mining, in which the miner becomes essentially a paid worker, a wage slave, if you will. And they go underground, and they do very, very dangerous kinds of work. Or they work in the hydraulic mines, but they're working for others. But the image of the individual miner is very valuable in stoking Americans' mythic belief in the power of the individual entrepreneur. But that plays a very, very minor role in mining, actually. It's a very, as it develops, it becomes a typical, I would say prototypical, capitalist enterprise in which the majority of people work for a very small number of people to make those very few people very rich.
And who were the people who you know, not the prospectors, but the people who worked in the mines, as in the sense that you're describing them? Who were these people?
Well, they were men. As far as I know, there weren't any women doing active mining, although there were a few who owned mines. But they tended to be immigrants because that kind of labor was cheap. They would be brought in from Europe, and occasionally they would use Chinese miners, but not very much in California, as I'm aware of. The value of using European immigrants is they spoke so many different languages, and so mine owners would frequently hire a number of people from different countries because they couldn't really communicate with each other, meaning that they couldn't organize a union. And mine owners hate unions, and so they try to keep the miners divided so that they can't organize for better wages and working conditions. It was a bit different on the Comstock Lode in Nevada up in Virginia City. The miners there did organize, and they got $4 a day, which was about the highest wage for miners in the world at that time. But they deserved it because those mines were some of the deepest and hottest in the world, and it was very dangerous kind of work to do. But those miners were largely Irish, Cornish, Welsh. My ancestors were coal miners from Wales. And so perhaps that's the reason I have such an interest in it, in addition to the fact I was originally going to be a geologist before I discovered geography. I like rocks.
But no coal in California, just as an aside. What happened there?
That's one of the interesting things about California. It's got nearly everything except good coal. There was some really poor-grade coal, basically a brown lignite, on the north slopes of Mount Diablo. And so that was exploited, and the poorer people in San Francisco used the coal from Mount Diablo. So it must have produced a huge amount of smoke at that time. I've only found a few references to that, but there was a big trade in coal because those were Welsh coal miners in Somerville and Nortonville up on Mount Diablo, and there were railroads that reached that from the Delta. They would go down to the Delta to Pittsburgh and I think Antioch, and they would take the coal down, and then it would be shipped into San Francisco and Oakland, wherever it could be used. Now, that kind of coal was not good for industry where you need bituminous or anthracite. So the industries and the wealthier people would order coal, their coal, from places as far away as New Zealand, Australia, even as far away as Wales itself. So there was a hefty trade in energy, in coal, being moved around the world into California because of the lack of coal. All that changed about 50 years after the gold rush, when we began finding that California was incredibly rich in petroleum down in Southern California in the San Joaquin Valley. And very few people realized that petroleum actually made far bigger fortunes than gold ever did. And that was centered around Los Angeles, actually. It's one of the reasons that Los Angeles starts growing so fast and beats San Francisco by 1920. It's largely doing that because it sits on an ocean of fossil fuel at that time. And, of course, there are advantages to petroleum in that it's liquid, and so it's much easier to use it, for example, in freighters and battleships crossing the Pacific than using coal.
Well, we've already gotten well into the next question that I wanted to ask you, and that was about environmentalism and about your interest in the environment. And again, you're the author of an important study here. It's called Farewell Promised Land, Waking from the California Dream. And it's a wonderful volume, a handsome volume with photos and prose from yourself and Robert Dawson. Was published, I think, in 1999. Is that right?
Yes, I have both my books in 1999.
So to move toward that subject, maybe first just a personal aside, and how did you get interested in environmentalism? It's clear that you are.
Well, I was a teenager growing up down the San Francisco Peninsula, and I read a book that came out in, I think it was 62 or maybe 63, that changed my life. That was Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. It changed a lot of people's lives. Previous to that, there hadn't really been such a thing as environmentalism. Rachel Carson was a beautiful writer. She was a naturalist, a scientist, and she produced this book that really was revolutionary. It said that we are essentially poisoning the earth with chemicals, particularly pesticides, herbicides. She called them biocides because they don't just target one individual organism. They get everything, and they have unintended consequences that we have no idea of. So there's a beautiful introduction to Silent Spring about, it's a kind of a fantasy of sometime in the future in which everything is very quiet when spring comes on. And she, it winds up, she said, they did it to themselves. And that book made, just sort of opened people's eyes to the fact that we were contaminating and poisoning the world with our chemicals. But Rachel Carson's interests or concerns were much bigger than that. She said that she actually began it because of her concern with radioactivity and nuclear power and how that was destroying or certainly poisoning the planet. I think she was going to write a sequel or planned to write a sequel on nuclear energy and its waste, but of course she didn't get around to that. Silent Spring set off a firestorm when it appeared. It was first published in installments in The New Yorker and then published as a book. The chemical industries just went after her hammer and tongs at that time. She was, they reviled her. They denigrated her as a hysterical woman. There was a great deal of misogyny in the attacks on her. She was a very fine scientist as well as a writer. And so she spent the last very difficult years of her life defending her thesis while she was dying of cancer. There's a very good book called After Silent Spring about the attacks on Rachel Carson. I think she's since been proved absolutely right. She's made it to a postage stamp even, which I guess is the final sign of official approval. And she's recognized as really a revolutionary and the pioneer mother of environmentalism now. But that's a long sidebar. That book changed my life, as did then reading Lewis Mumford soon thereafter when I went to architecture school. I read The City and History and The Pentagon of Power, and those were also books that changed my life, too.
This is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. This is the first in a new series for KZYX on California and talking about California. It will be broadcast on Thursdays at, I guess it's 9, for the next few weeks. Our first guest is Gray Brecken. We're talking with Gray Brecken, a historical geographer from the University of California today. We'll go ahead with Gray now. Gray, the book that I mentioned, Farewell Promised Land, Waking from the California Dream, maybe you could, what's the title all about? And, what were you doing when you began and completed that work?
Well, I chose that title because California has always been associated with dreaming, the California dream. And because, well, you mentioned at the beginning that the draw of California, it's drawn people ever since the gold rush, largely because of its climate and its scenery, facing the Pacific, et cetera. And it is, in so many ways, a wonderful place, especially along the coast and in the Sierra. And so the name of the game has been real estate. It's promoting the state so that people will move here and increase the value of the real estate for those people who own it. So very few people actually got rich in the gold rush. The people who got rich were those who acquired land by whatever means necessary. I stress that. And then held on to it and eventually began subdividing and selling it off. And those are the bases, that's the base of many of the great fortunes. So California has always been about self-promotion, and Hollywood was very important in that. Many of the movie stars and the studio heads actually owned a great deal of Southern California real estate. So the more enticing they could make California look, the more people it would attract, and that would increase the value of their land. Now, the problem with that is that the cities know no limits. They are just growing out of all bounds. They're not like Italian cities, I can tell you. So they just sprawl out forever and are covering all of our best agricultural soil and exhausting our water supplies, et cetera. So Bob Dawson and I wanted to document that, and so we just set out, and over about 5 years or so, we drove all over California looking at it and taking its environmental pulse. And I can tell you, it's not good. Bob's a superb photographer, and his photographs really captured the kind of, what I feel is the kind of mournful, almost elegiacal quality of California, of a place that I love so much. As I watch it being just sort of consumed, I liken it to a bread mold consuming a piece of bread or an orange being consumed. Because there's no limit to growth in California, and the environmental costs are just mounting. They're almost exponential now. So we looked at it in that way, and Kevin Starr has written a whole series of wonderful books on the California dream, and I hope I didn't co-opt him on this, but I thought, well, what's the dream? You know, it's something you have while you're sleeping. It doesn't have anything to do with reality, quite the opposite. So,
and Kevin Starr is, for our listeners?
Oh, Kevin Starr is a sort of California's great chronicler and historian. He was the state librarian for many years, and he's written a whole series of volumes which are very synthetic about California and its place in America. You should have Kevin on sometime, too, to talk about the work that he's done. He's much more prolific than I am. So I just wanted to say, you know, well, this is about waking from the dream and seeing what's really around us and what we're doing to the place. I will tell you, it took a toll on me. It was very depressing to look at a place that I love so much and see what's happening to it, and particularly the poisoning of so much of it, especially the Central Valley, the Sacramento and the San Joaquin Valley, which especially the San Joaquin Valley is just a toxic wasteland, because of the chemicals that are applied there and that people live with. And we visited several of the small towns there that have cancer clusters, birth defects, et cetera. The water, the air, the land, everything is contaminated there. It's really Rachel Carson's Silent Spring come true. And there are places that you can stand in the valley and you won't hear a thing, because we've just annihilated nature there. I remember when I was a kid and we would cross the Central Valley to get to the Sierra, and you'd have to have a bug guard in the front of your car because there were so many insects that they'd just choke up your engine. Well, you don't have to do that anymore because the insects are all gone. And of course, along with the insects go the birds, too. That's one of the reasons that when you walk in a forest these days, they're often very, very quiet. And if you're old as I am, you remember when that was not the case, that forests were lively places to be in, but they're often very quiet now. And that's because of things we've done, but most people don't notice it because it sneaks up on you.
So, Gray, twice now you've sort of said you like the coast and you like the mountains, but the in-between, the valley. Again, thinking about your book, it seems to me that you suggest that the valley wasn't always a place that you wanted to get behind you.
No, I'm fascinated by the valley, and I didn't mean to shirk it. It's just that, you know, compared with the rest of California, it's not that scenic, except on a clear day when you can actually see the mountains from it. It's an amazing place. It's a valley 500 miles long and about 40 miles wide and filled with rich alluvial soil. It's a fascinating place. I actually really enjoy driving around in it and visiting the towns and cities in it. But it's also a sad place because of the environment and because the cities, especially places like Bakersfield and Fresno, Visalia, are now basically in a state, oh, in Stockton, too, a once great city, now going bankrupt. Those places are really in a state of depression now for a variety of reasons. So when you live in the Bay Area, you know, you're kind of sheltered from that because there's so much money sloshing around in the Bay Area, largely because of Silicon Valley and the weapons industries that bring in so much money into California, especially the Bay Area. And so we don't realize that there are large parts of California that are now in a state analogous to the Great Depression.
I think
where the unemployment rate could be 50%, for example.
I was just going to say, I think that if you looked at the labor statistics from the government, you'd find out that the majority of the top 10 cities in the entire country in terms of unemployment are in the California Central Valley and down on the border at El Centro, where, as you just said, there are unemployment rates up in the high 20s.
Oh, they're way higher than that,
are
actually.
They?
Places like Mendota and Huron. It depends, of course, on what season it is, whether there's water coming down the canal, et cetera, because if there's not water, then they just shut down agribusiness and they and then there's just massive unemployment. But there's far more labor than can actually be used, and, of course, the growers like that a lot because it can keep the wages low. And then the air is, especially in the San Joaquin Valley, which is a closed basin, is just terrible. The asthma rates are very high there. So it's a tragedy because it's one of the world's great agriculture regions. It provides a huge amount of food and fiber, nuts, et cetera, because of the year-round climate in which you can grow things. So it's a fascinating place, and I recommend that people get to know it better, but it certainly has a lot of social and environmental problems.
So I think you've answered my other question here, that the volume that we've been talking about, Farewell Promised Land, is a bit gloomy, I guess. You've answered the question as to whether or not things have changed for the better at all since then.
Well, you know, Cal, in some ways it's gotten a lot worse because, when Bob and I started working on the book, the Berlin Wall had just come down, and we thought we were going to get a peace dividend, and so the U.S. was closing military bases all over California and shutting down some of the weapons contractors, what we call defense. And it was practically a state of depression in Southern California, which relied so much on aerospace industry and the military at that time. And it was then that I realized that the old saying that war is the health of the state, it's also the health of the city, too, the preparation for war, and that so much of our economy was dependent on that, and the worst thing that could happen to it was peace, or the prospect of peace. So, of course, since then, we've been lucky. We've ginned up several other wars and a war on terror, and so now the war industries are back in full health again.
Well, maybe on that note, we should move on. my last question, we might sneak in one more, but my last question really is about a project that you spoke to us about in Casper last year, and that's your work in the Living New Deal project. And I think the best thing for listeners might be if you could just say what the project's about, what you're working on, and why it's of interest.
Well, Well, in some ways, it's an outgrowth of the work that I was doing in the 90s and even before, and those two books that we were talking about, especially Farewell Promised Land, because I was really in a state of depression about what I'd seen and written about, and I was looking for something that was a little bit more upbeat, and I thought I was going to write a book about WPA projects around California. The Works Progress Administration was an emergency work relief program instituted during the 30s by the Roosevelt administration to put people back to work. And I was intrigued by seeing WPA markers in various places, like the Berkeley Rose Garden says, you know, there's a bronze plaque. It says, constructed by WPA 1937. And so I knew a little bit about that. I knew a little bit about the Civilian Conservation Corps. So I thought I could do a book on that. But the more I got into it, the more I realized, holy cow, there's just so much more. And there are other agencies like the Public Works Administration, Farm Securities Administration, Civil Works Administration. All these agencies, these alphabet soup agencies, were created to give people work and to put the nation back on its feet. And what happened is that they, within about 6 or 7 years, they left us a colossal legacy of indispensable public works, most of which is not marked, much of which is extremely beautiful, like the post offices that were built at that time, often embellished with federal art. And it's all around us, but we don't see it, and we're not meant to see it, because to do so means that you'd be able to see what government at its best and most compassionate can accomplish for all of its citizens rather than just the few who can afford to buy it. And so what happened is that the book became an open-source website, the Living New Deal. It's livingnewdeal.berkeley.edu, and you can go there. And we've been working on it because it's really a team effort based at the UC Berkeley Geography Department. It's a team effort to identify and map and interpret the New Deal public works now all over the United States. They began just as the California Living New Deal. Now we're taking on the whole country. Because we really want to show what government can do and how it, we're all dependent on it. We rely upon the New Deal, like the water systems that they built, the water disposal systems, sewage systems, the parks that they built, the schools, the bridges, the roads, etc. We're using it all the time without knowing it. And it's a good thing they built as well as they did during that time, because they never imagined that we would vote to cut our taxes so that we would not continue to maintain it, let alone expand it, which is why all the infrastructure is falling apart in the U.S. now. As I say, it's a good thing that they built as well as they did, because it's held up for now about 80 years, but much of it is ready to collapse. But it really has been a fascinating project. I know what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life, because there's no way that you can ever get to the bottom of it. And it's tremendously cheered me up to come into contact with people of the gigantic caliber and thoughtfulness of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt and the people that they gathered around themselves. I wish we could see people like that today, but unfortunately they seem to be in awfully short supply.
Did you find anything up this way for your study, Mendocino County or Northern California?
Oh, it's all over the place. Every town has something in it. One of my favorites is Mendocino Woodlands, which was created by the Civilian Conservation Corps on logged over timberlands. And there were about 46 of these built. They were called demonstration recreation areas around the country. And they were first off to restore damaged land, but then also to give working class people places to recreate. Previous to that, only the wealthy and the upper middle classes could afford to have that kind of recreation. But the New Deal built a number of these around the country where working class people could go and enjoy themselves. And Mendocino Woodlands is the last one still being used for that very purpose. The other ones have been repurposed or have disappeared. One of those demonstration areas is now called Camp David. It's where the president goes into Maryland when he wants to get away from business. That was a demonstration recreational camp. But the roads, like Highway 1 along the coast, that was largely done as a New Deal project. The roads over the Coast Range, largely done by the CCC and the WPA. I would suspect that most of your towns probably have water systems that were built by the WPA. Landing strips, our airports were WPA. Up in Eureka, the auditorium there is WPA or PWA, I can't remember which. And many of your schools, the one in Fort Bragg.
I think Cotton Auditorium in Fort Bragg is...
Cotton Auditorium, yeah. Unusual, because mostly they would build in fireproof materials, but there, because there was so much redwood and it was so cheap, they built it out of wood, I guess with a lot of fire exits. It's all over the place. You just don't see it, and we're going to try to make people see it. Oh, and of course also the post office murals in places like Ukiah, which has just had its post office closed, had a lovely mural in it. Sebastopol has one. It's just everywhere. And it made our lives much, much better.
So, last words, I guess. Is there something for us today in the story of the WPA?
Well, I think what's in it for us now is to be aware that we once had this, that this wasn't utopia. We actually built these things. We had a kind of government that thought about the common people and how to give them their self-respect back when they'd lost it through no fault of their own by losing their jobs, and by creating socially beneficial jobs that the market will seldom, if ever, create. And so it gave people a sense of pride, and it also was very effective in getting us out of the Depression, contrary to what the New Deal's eternal enemies like to claim. It was very effective because by the time of Pearl Harbor, the country was still in a state of recession, but it certainly wasn't in the Great Depression anymore, and that was largely because of these public works. So people have to know this so that they have a yardstick by which to measure today's present leaders, and they'll find them coming up very wanting because, for example, in the present administration, a program like the WPA was never considered, let alone the Civilian Conservation Corps. Both of these programs were... the workers were paid directly by the federal government. So rather than trickle down from on top through contractors, the workers were paid directly by the federal government. And it was very effective in raising the whole economy from the bottom. Because when you pay poor people directly to do socially beneficial work, that money immediately goes right into the economic system. It's mainlines the economic system, and it gets it going again. And that's something that we really need to remember, and we can do that by looking back at what those people did. And finally, the last thing is, we want to honor those veterans of our peacetime army. If they're still around, they're in their 80s and their 90s, and they've never been thanked in the way that we've thanked our and honored our wartime veterans. They've been largely forgotten, and we want to remember them. In the case of the CCC, by at some of their great projects, erecting life-size statues of the CCC boys, like at Mountain Theater and Mount Tamalpais, so the people who go by there will know that this didn't just happen. It happened by putting people, young men, to work, and it immeasurably improved their lives in doing so.
And ours, Gray, I think we're running out of time. Today we've been talking to Gray Brecken. Gray's an historic geographer at the University of California. This is Cal Winslow. I'm hosting a new series on KZYX talking about California. We'll be back next week. Gray, thank you very much. It's been very interesting.
Thanks, Cal. It was a lot of fun.
All right, and good morning to you. Good morning, listeners, and thanks for listening. Bye-bye.